Hey guys, welcome to Cracked. I'm your host, Justina Tucker, and I'm here with co-host, Jen Troyer.
Hey guys!
Today, we will be continuing the story we started last episode, so if you haven't listened to that yet, go back and check it out before we continue. This is the story of how one of America's greatest heroes became a suspect in a police investigation for a gruesome murder. Some say it's the trial of the century. This is the story of O.J. Simpson, Part 2. Again, I do want to stress that this case contains mature content and we don't recommend listening if you're under the age of 13. We are going to be discussing some very heavy race issues that may be sensitive to certain listeners. We will be talking about domestic violence, so please be advised of that as well. I also want to make note that you can follow along with us on our website. We will have photographs posted under this case's page. Please view these at your own discretion, for they are a little graphic. Now, last week, Jen and I left you with a bit of a cliffhanger, so I think that's where we'll pick up our story. On June 13, 1994, police arrive at Nicole Brown's home around 4:25 a.m. There is music playing quietly in the background and candles are lit. On the pathway leading up to the door, police are met with a trail of blood, which they follow and leads to the most gruesome crime scene that I've ever seen. Lying just inside the gate, halfway perched on one of the steps, is 35-year-old mother of two, Nicole Brown. She died of a wound to her neck that severed both carotid arteries. She also had multiple severed veins in her neck. The wound was so deep it sliced a quarter of an inch through Nicole's C3 vertebrae. So in essence, poor Nicole Simpson was basically decapitated in her own yard.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. Like, that just sounds terrible. Wait, hold on. I thought you said in the last episode that there were two victims.
I did. The other victim was Ron Goldman. We didn't mention him in the last episode. He was a waiter at the Mezzaluna. Sydney, Nicole and OJ's daughter, had a recital on the evening of the 12th. Afterwards, Nicole and her family went to the Mezzaluna. Nicole's mom left her glasses there, and Ron said that he would take them to Nicole's house after he got off work. So he went over there and either the killer walked in on Nicole and Ron, or more likely, Ron walked in on the killer killing Nicole. Ron suffered similar injuries to Nicole. He also had a gaping wound in his neck, and he died of blood loss, which occurred because of two fatal stab wounds to his aorta. He also had numerous slashes to his neck and other parts of his body.
So this was, like, way more than what needed to be done to kill him and Nicole.
Yes, absolutely. This is literally the definition of overkill. And oftentimes, my inner profiler is going to come out for just a sec. When you have a case of overkill, it usually represents anger, and that typically would lead investigators to believe that it was someone who knew the victims. And sometimes it can mean the victim is a surrogate for the real target, but in this case, it was believed that Nicole was the intended target.
Got it.
There are a few other important things I want to mention as well. Alongside the bodies was a very large black glove, a left glove to be exact. There were also drops of blood walking away from the bodies that appeared to be coming from the left side of the perpetrator. In my opinion, the worst part about this entire scene was that Sydney and Justin, Nicole's kids, were asleep upstairs the entire time and they could have walked down and found their mother in that state.
Did they?
Thankfully, they did not. One of the officers at the scene was Mark Furman. He was called to Rockingham a few years prior because of a domestic dispute, so he knew where OJ lived. Police drove to Rockingham because typical procedure is to alert the closest living relative of the deceased. When they arrive at Rockingham, the gate is obviously locked, and while they are waiting for the gate to be unlocked, Furman walks around the outside of the property. When he approaches OJ's white Ford Bronco, he notices blood on the driver's side door handle. He shined a flashlight inside and saw a few spots of blood on the inside of the Bronco as well.
Oh no. Did they know whose blood it was?
Well, no, not right away, because those things take a long time to process, and the police's immediate assumption was that someone was hurt inside. So they hopped over the fence to find OJ wasn't home. OJ had these bungalows behind his house, so police go and knock on the door with one of the bungalows that has its lights on. Cato Kalin, who was a friend of OJ's and the tenant of the bungalow, answered the door. He tells police that OJ left for Chicago earlier that evening. He tells police that he heard thumping on the outside of his house earlier. Furman goes out to check this, and you'll never believe what he found.
Oh no. What?
He found the right glove that matched the left glove found on Bundy Drive at Nicole's house.
No way. So they've gotta be looking at OJ now.
I think this is when they realize it is possible that he could be involved. And when police call Nicole's family, you can hear her sister Denise screaming in the background, saying that she knew OJ was going to kill Nicole. When OJ came back to Brentwood later on the 13th, police took him to the backyard of Rockingham and they handcuffed him. OJ goes down to the police station and agrees to talk. And they also notice, get this, that he had an injury to his left hand.
Holy S-word. How did he get it?
Well, that's the thing. Police ask him, but he doesn't really give them a straight answer, and they don't really pry. He tells them that he cut it in Chicago on a piece of glass, and then he says that the blood in the Bronco is from his hand, which doesn't make any sense, because if he cut his hand in Chicago, the blood would not have been inside of the Bronco.
And the police don't question this?
No, not really. They take a picture of his hand and get a blood sample, but then they send him on his way. In the meantime, police work on establishing a timeline for the night of June 12th. At 5 p.m., OJ, Nicole, and Nicole's family attend Sydney's dance recital. At 6:30, Nicole and her family go to the Mezzaluna for dinner.
Did OJ not go to that?
No, he actually was not invited. At 9:36 p.m., OJ and Cato Kalin return from a trip to McDonald's. At 9:37 p.m., Nicole's mom calls the Mezzaluna asking about her glasses. Around 10 p.m., Ron Goldman, the waiter, takes an envelope containing Judy Brown's glasses to Nicole's house on Bundy Drive. And I do want to make note that the envelope was found by the bodies. At approximately 10:15, a neighbor of Nicole's hears her dog barking. At 11:15, OJ was picked up at Rockingham by a limo and was driven to LAX. Then, at 11:45, OJ flew to Chicago for a Hertz golfing event.
It seems a little weird that there was no activity for OJ between the time that Nicole and Ron were probably killed.
Yeah, I agree. It is very strange. I want to take a second to introduce two very key players on OJ's defense team, which is often referred to as the, quote, dream team. Robert Shapiro was OJ's original lead defense lawyer. He is often described as a Hollywood lawyer because he represented many famous people. He wasn't known for his trials, but he was known for settling and cutting deals. Another important person to note is Robert Kardashian.
Wait, Kardashian? As in, like, Kim Kardashian?
Actually, yes, it was her father. And get this, OJ was Kim's godfather.
No way. That's crazy.
I know, I thought so too. And actually, Kris Kardashian, now Kris Jenner, actually was really good friends with Nicole, and she was at her wake. OJ was also at Nicole's wake, and Tanya Brown, Nicole's sister, said that she thought OJ was sedated for the whole thing. One very important day in this case is June 17th, 5 days after Nicole and Ron's murders. One very important day in this case is June 17th, 5 days after Nicole and Ron's murders. Robert Shapiro was getting ready to cut a deal with police where OJ would turn himself in at 11 a.m. to avoid a, quote, media circus. However, when 11 rolls around and OJ doesn't show, police begin a search. Shortly after that, Robert Kardashian holds a press conference where he reads a letter that OJ wrote shortly before he fled. In this letter, OJ said that he didn't have anything to do with Nicole's death. He basically was saying he was lost and had no purpose. At this point, everyone was thinking that OJ must have committed suicide.
Oh my gosh, wait, he didn't try to, did he?
No, he didn't. The last person OJ was seen with was a childhood friend of his named Al Collins, but everyone called him AC. Soon after this, OJ's Bronco was spotted on the freeway. Police begin chasing him, and they close in quickly. Once they are in hot pursuit, AC calls 911 and tells the operator to have police back off because OJ has a gun to his own head and is threatening to kill himself. He was saying that he wanted to go home and see his mom.
What the heck? That makes him look super guilty. So do police, like, actually back off, or do they close in?
No, they backed up and began following him home. If you look at the images we have on our website, you'll see that this looks more like a police escort than a car chase. While they were following him, people lined the overpass with signs saying, quote, "Free OJ," or, quote, "Set the juice loose."
Are you joking? It's literally a police chase and two people were slaughtered. Why do they want him loose?
Well, because he's their hero. I mean, he was this huge star. The only thing I can think to relate it to would be like LeBron James. He was really good at his sport and everybody loved him. When OJ arrived back at Rockingham, police got him on the phone and tried to coax him out of the car without the gun. AC eventually gets out and goes inside. OJ, sometime later, also gets out and collapses into police's arms. This is one moment where it was hard not to feel bad for OJ. You could see how broken he was. Then, of course, you realize everything he's done and snap out of it. But this is just one instance throughout this entire case where people really do feel bad for OJ. When OJ had his plea hearing, he pled not guilty. In fact, his exact words were, quote, absolutely, 100% not guilty, end quote.
I really am getting very bad vibes from him.
Yeah, and people at the time didn't realize how guilty he looked, but looking back on it, it's really easy to see that he was hiding stuff. The judge for OJ's case was named Lance Ito. When it comes time to select the jury, the prosecution and the defense both have to be very careful because of the race issues in LA. And when understanding the fact that no matter what OJ thought, he was black and some people may alter their decisions because of that.
Does race end up playing a big part of this trial?
It does. In my opinion, I don't think it should because I don't see how it's relevant, but it does end up being a very important part of this case. The black females were also a big problem for the prosecution when being added to the jury because they had hard feelings over the fact that OJ ended up with a white girl.
Why is that bad for the prosecution?
Well, because they take it out on Nicole instead of on OJ, and they had a hard time sympathizing with Nicole. They also despised Marcia Clark, who was the lead prosecutor. Marcia was very tough and didn't mess around in court, so it's possible that she intimidated them too much. When jury selection is finished, they end up having 8 African-American women, so the prosecution is already fighting an uphill battle. Two other members of the Dream Team that I want to mention are Johnny Cochran and Carl Douglas. Cochran, who is a civil rights lawyer, actually becomes OJ's lead attorney. When OJ finds out about the statistics for his jury, he tells Cochran and Douglas, quote, if this jury convicts me, maybe I did do it, end quote.
You're kidding me. He's actually joking around about this?
Yeah, well, remember, OJ had this sense of entitlement and stuck-upness about himself. Right before opening statements, Chris Darden joins the prosecution, and keep in mind that Darden is actually black. Cochran will later argue that the prosecution was using Darden to warm up to the jury. The prosecution's opening statements don't really stand out much, but the defense blows everyone away. They make bold statements about LAPD being racist and that they were out to get OJ, and even that the glove found at Rockingham was planted by none other than Detective Mark Furman himself. Basically, right from the get-go, the defense plays the, quote, race card, and tries to convince the jury that OJ was a victim to the racist pigs at LAPD, and tries to convince the jury that OJ was a victim to the racist pigs at LAPD and that he loved Nicole and wouldn't hurt her.
I mean, obviously no one believed this, right? Of course he did it. He abused her for 7 years, and there's so much evidence leading directly to OJ's front door. I mean, how could you believe he didn't do it?
Well, the crazy thing is that people did believe it. There was a very large portion of America who believed OJ was set up and that he should be set free.
You're kidding. What happened after that?
Well, I'd love to tell you, but you're gonna have to stick around for the next episode to find out all the ups and downs of this trial and the banter between the prosecution and the defense.
Come on, don't do me like that.
I know, but it'll be good. Just wait.
Thank you to everyone who listened in today. There is so much more to this case that Tristina is going to tell us, so make sure to come back in 2 weeks for more riveting details. Please be sure to give us a follow on Instagram at cracked.crime.podcast and Twitter at crackedcrime. You can also visit us on our website, which is linked in our bio. Feel free to send us an email with any case suggestions or questions regarding this case at crackedcrimepodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, and be sure to tune in next time for Cracked.